This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
These days, you and I face situations we've never encountered before. It's climate change, terrorism, a new disease, or maybe even an economic crash. But humans and their governments can act on experience, not the future. As our next guest can tell us, responses based on the past can fail badly. Catherine Miles has an exciting new book out about Hurricane Sandy. That's the monster storm that flooded New York City and wrecked much of New England's shore in late October 2012. Miles tells the gripping tale in Superstorm, 9 days inside Hurricane Sandy. But I think the storm and the book are also a lens for looking at preparedness during a time of climate disruption. Catherine has written several books. She's a science writer published in Outside Magazine, Popular Mechanics, and many other periodicals. Miles is currently writer-in-residence at Green Mountain College in Vermont. Catherine, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. Now, was Hurricane Sandy the largest storm ever seen just in the North Atlantic or the largest storm seen anywhere in modern times?
The largest hurricane in the North Atlantic. And I can't confirm it, but I believe that also makes it the largest storm on record.
And how big was it?
At the height of the storm, it was over 1,000 miles in diameter. And so, it was covering an area that was larger than Europe. And the damage that it left was larger than a couple Europe. So immense in terms of its reach.
And before this giant arrived in America, it swept across the Caribbean. What happened there?
Well, it began as a very traditional hurricane in the southern Caribbean and did a fair amount of damage in Jamaica. Haiti in particular was very hard hit. Cuba was where it was its strongest. But, for all the damage it did in those places, it was behaving as a hurricane, and it was behaving in ways that both emergency managers and meteorologists knew how to handle. It was when it crossed over the Bahamas and began to transition into this hybrid storm that it became really problematic for everyone involved.
Well, sure, we all think we know the storm pattern from the TV news of the past. A hurricane boils up from the Caribbean, it hits or misses the south, whether it's Florida or the Gulf states, and then it gets blown by the winds or the Earth's rotation out to the Atlantic. How and why did Sandy get turned back on New England?
There were several things that were sort of weather miracles, if you will, that shouldn't have happened that led to that. Storms, particularly the hurricanes of these nature, they're really powerful, but they don't have a lot of propulsive power of their own. One meteorologist who I spoke to likened them to logs or twigs that are moving on a really sort of rapidly moving river or stream. And so they get caught up in these currents and they go where the currents go. There's a blocking high pressure system that sits over the Bahamas and up around Bermuda. Usually that blocking high works almost as a pinball effect. A hurricane will hit it and bounce off and head into the North Atlantic. This particular year, that high pressure system was not located there. And so it gave the storm really easy egress to move up. And as it did, it was caught by the Gulf Stream. And again, in 2012, the Gulf Stream was behaving in a way that is really unusual. It usually flows pretty typically from west to east. And in this particular case, it was making these really wonky kind of undulating patterns. And so it happened to be the case that it was undulating to the north, right where Sandy caught it. And then a very unusual high-pressure system was sitting over Greenland, and that's what caused it, to kind of pinball into Manhattan. So it was the impossible scenario made possible.
I imagine you must ask yourself whether climate change was involved in such an unusual storm. We'll be talking more about that, but in general, what did you conclude?
This is an unusually, and for me, very surprisingly contentious issue in meteorological circles. I was really unprepared for the level of debate and sometimes vitriol among meteorologists about climate change. What we do know for a fact is that hurricanes derive their energy from warm water, and the oceans are getting warmer. They were exceptionally warm in 2012, so that's part of what drove Sandy's ferocious power. We also know that climate change is responsible for sea level rise. The larger that we get in terms of that sea level rise happening, what happens as a result is then surge becomes exponentially greater. So places that were never before at risk of storm surge damage are now very much at risk. So those are two undeniable facts. The rest is very much a debate among meteorologists, which is interesting to me because it's not among climatologists.
Oh, we could spend a long time talking about the division between those two communities, although the American Meteorological Society just came out with a report saying that definitely climate change is human-induced and it's here. Now, I want to ask you, you spend some time in your book on the failed social responses on several levels, and I'd like to start, and remember, we have quite a few international listeners as well. Can you explain the different government weather services that come into play when a hurricane is spotted?
Every country in the area where hurricanes or typhoons can hit has its own tropical storm forecasting system. Met Cuba is a fantastic program. We rely on them a lot for data and information. Cuba was one of the early sort of experts in hurricane science, and they remain a real leader. So there's a very sort of congenial relationship between these different countries and how they interact. The people at the National Hurricane Center, the forecasters there, are regularly on the phone with other countries. Sometimes it's to get information, sometimes it's to give information. We're in something of a weather satellite crisis right now in terms of our ability to forecast. Several key instruments that our meteorologists use are either broken or nearing the end of their lifespan. So they've started to branch off into other countries to derive information from people like the European Union, India, Canada as well, too. So very much a collaborative effort, both for good and for bad, I think.
And unbelievably, by official policy, the National Hurricane Center seems to have been stuck on the label given to a storm. Why did they back off on Sandy, and what did that mean for judgments made by local authorities?
The National Hurricane Center is sort of hemmed in by the definitions that are handed to it by the National Weather Service and NOAA. And in this particular case, at the time of Sandy, they were operating under a very strict definition and protocol. And that was that the National Hurricane Center forecasts tropical storms and only tropical storms. Sandy transitioned into a hybrid storm. It became part nor'easter, part tropical storm. And so it gained a new definition. The technical word for what Sandy was is what's called an extropical system. Once it became that, the National Hurricane Center quite literally could not issue watches, warnings, and advisories. What they told me was they thought that if they tried, they could literally break their software.
Catherine Miles, please take a few minutes to explain the different responses by New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. I think there's some important lessons to be learned there.
This is a fascinating study. In New Jersey, what we saw was very decisive action by Governor Christie. He was being fed information by both the National Hurricane Center initially and then his local forecasting office. He took that information and very quickly started to make a series of very strong statements. He's a politician who's really sort of defined himself by speaking in these sort of colloquialisms. And so he would stand up on TV and he would say things like, look, don't be stupid, get out, get off the beach, get the hell off the beach in some cases. And, you know, some people kind of poke fun at him for that, but it worked. The message really got to New Jerseyans very clearly. And about 72 to 96 hours before Superstorm Sandy made landfall in New Jersey, he made the decision to call for initially voluntary evacuations, and then very quickly he made mandatory evacuation notices. What social scientists tell us is that citizens need up to 72 hours to really internalize that information and act. If you tell someone you need to get out today, people are not inclined to get out. They need 3 days of repeated warnings to really believe that the threat is real. And that's what Governor Christie gave them. And so we saw fairly good evacuation rates in those areas. Mayor Bloomberg, who had called for massive evacuations the year before during Hurricane Irene, had actually come under a fair amount of criticism for his decision to evacuate during Irene, which famously did next to no damage on the coast, but in fact flooded and did a lot of damage to inland areas, places like upstate New York and Vermont. So those people who had left during Hurricane Irene only to find themselves trapped by inland flooding and then returned home to find their houses looted thought this is kind of one of those fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, shame on you situations. And so they were already a tough sell in terms of getting out. Mayor Bloomberg's office, and I spoke extensively both to his staff and also to people at upper levels of his New York City Office of Emergency Management, they all said the same thing, which is, look, we felt like we were operating in the fog of war. We had drilled. We thought we were going to be getting information like surge data from the National Hurricane Center, but all of a sudden, we were getting it from this regional National Weather Service office. We were confused. We didn't feel confident about it. We saw the numbers and we thought, this is going to be another Irene. They were, of course, catastrophically wrong. But Mayor Bloomberg, about 48 hours before the storm hit, Mayor Bloomberg took to the airwaves and staged this sort of bizarre press conference where he told New Yorkers it was going to be fine, that city employees should report to work, that all they needed to do was maybe weigh down their garbage cans with a brick or something. And so he sent this sort of sense of calm among New Yorkers that was very confusing for them, because they could see that Governor Christie, that the governor of Connecticut, Delaware were issuing evacuations. But here we had this very well-respected mayor of New York saying everything's going to be fine. Of course, it wasn't. When he made that press conference, people in the meteorological world sort of instantly jumped to red alert. Lots of phone calls, lots of flurries of calls and texts and information as everyone tried to persuade him that he had made this terrible mistake. And in this really sort of harrowing 12 hours where everyone is up all night trying to persuade New York that they've made a mistake, a lot of confused information was being sent around. So by the time he did issue evacuation orders, New Yorkers had fewer than 8 hours to get out of the city before mass transit was closed. New Yorkers with functional needs and disabilities had fewer than 6 hours to get out before their transportation was canceled. So we saw some people trying to get out who quite literally couldn't. They were trapped, and some of them died.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Catherine Miles, author of Superstorm, 9 days Inside Hurricane Sandy. Catherine, let's talk about the role in media in this. How did the mainstream media handle this story?
This is a really sort of complex issue, and a lot of people point to the role of the media as a real player in terms of the confusion and the lack of evacuation and proper response. In multiple countries, places like Japan, places like Canada, places like England, their national weather system is directly tied to a national broadcasting system. So in those countries, what happens is the meteorologists, the federal meteorologists, make a warning, make a forecast. It's delivered directly to the nightly news or whoever the case may be, the radio, and it's delivered verbatim. So there's this direct line of communication. In the United States, our National Weather Service is kind of like the sort of classic statue of justice, where she's standing there blindfolded and holding out her hands. And that's kind of how our meteorologists operate. They hold out these forecasts, hoping that people will take them, interpret them correctly, and relay them. But what we're seeing is this real sort of democratization of the media, where all of a sudden, lots of people have access to weather data. Some people choose to use the National Weather Service data. We also have companies like AccuWeather, the Weather Channel, who are doing their own forecasting, in some cases completely independent of the National Weather Service. And then we have local meteorologists as well, too. And so there's some of these meteorologists choose to report that what the National Weather Service says verbatim. Some choose to interpret it. And some choose to go completely on their own and come up with their own forecast. So we see a lot of misinformation. We also know that nothing sells news more like natural disaster. So we see, unfortunately, some media channels choosing to really sort of hype and overhype storms. And I think some people start to develop a kind of tolerance to that hype. And so it's kind of a big bad wolf scenario.
So many of our listeners do worry we're living in a time of decline. What did you find out about the state of America's front lines on weather forecasting, so important in an era of climate disruption?
This was the surprise for me in researching this book, and it's very much become my focus since writing it. What I uncovered through my research was nothing short of a meteorological infrastructure crisis in this country. NOAA has been consistently underfunded since its inception in 1970, and it was placed in the Department of Commerce, which is not a logical fit for it. So for years, for decades, we've underfunded NOAA, and what was once one of the best meteorological programs in the entire world has really fallen on tough times. We have hundreds of staff shortages and openings for top-level forecasters and technicians. Again, I mentioned earlier this outmoded and broken equipment. So while we still have some of the best and most highly trained meteorologists in the world, they're hemmed in by staffing crises. They're hemmed in by the technology that's available to them. They're hemmed in by the sort of bureaucratic rules that don't let the National Hurricane Center forecast certain storms. And so really it is a crisis. It's an infrastructure crisis as much as the electric grid or bridges or anything else are. And as we saw with the recent hacks, the computer hacks of NOAA, it's also a national security crisis.
Wow. And you're right about the flaw in judging risk based on everything being okay in the past. That really caught my attention. Please tell us how that played out with Robin Waldrich, the captain of the sailing ship, the Bounty.
In a lot of ways, Robin Waldrich was a metaphor for how all of us deal with risk. And here he was this captain of a wooden vessel that was built for the 1962 movie Mutiny on the Bounty. He made the catastrophic decision to sail into the storm. He had sailed through several other hurricanes and been successful. He assumed he could be successful in this one. He was getting misinformation from his onshore manager, who was misinterpreting the forecasts. So while a lot of people have seen him as a rogue captain, I see him more as emblematic of the decisions we all make. You know, 70% of people who were told to evacuate in the storm didn't, and it was a kind of hubris. They assumed they would be safe. Captain Waldrich assumed he would be. So did Mayor Bloomberg. And so I really wanted to call attention to the decisions that we all make about risk, because as I think you alluded to, everything we knew about weather is changing. And so using old models or what happened in the past just doesn't work for us anymore for any meteorological disaster. And it's really beholden on us to accept that and change our sense of risk.
Now, you talked about the storm surge. Was that a gradual ocean rising over a period of a day or two, or was it a stunning arrival? What did it look like?
It was a stunning arrival. And the people that I talked to said, look, you can't even make a horror movie that would describe what this was. It was literally walls of water. 1 second, something would be dry, and another second, it was overtaking entire cars. And so again, here's a case where we collectively, as a culture, have underestimated storm surge. The U.S. has only one storm surge expert working for the entire country. Storm surge used to be thought of as this sort of gradual rising because we're used to storm surge happening in places like the Gulf of Mexico, where there are not dramatic tides, there are not dramatic sea level changes. And so surge is a very different beast there than it is in places like the Eastern Seaboard, or as we saw in the Philippines with the recent typhoon, again, very dramatic surge. We're not used to seeing it in these places, so we don't really know how to deal with it. But what we do know is that historically, surge kills exponentially more people than wind. And really, that's the danger in a tropical storm.
Yeah, these storm surges are really the early warning system of rising seas due to a hotter ocean and melting glaciers. And it worries me what we talked about earlier, that some weather specialists are actually climate deniers and others are not, of course. But we have to count on these people to realize that this is the start of a new era of terrible storms, as climate scientists are warning us, due to climate change. How do you see this playing out? Will Hurricane Sandy bring about more of a change in that direction?
I hope so. It's remarkable because, the angry letters that I've gotten from this book have all been from climate change denying meteorologists, which is not anything I expected. But what we do know for a fact is that the climate is changing. We know this. We know that sea levels are rising. We know that the seas are getting warmer. And we know that this affects storms. Meteorologists may still be debating exactly how it affects them. But what I've heard from multiple meteorologists is, look, this idea of the storm of the century, you have to get rid of it. It might have been the storm of the century a couple of centuries ago, but we're in a new era, and we're in an era where these storms are going to keep happening and where they're going to happen in places we don't expect. We're going to see typhoons in Hawaii. We're going to see superstorms hitting Alaska. We're going to see storms increasingly hitting places like New England. And until we adjust and until we sort of accept that this is an unknown, we are all at risk of weather.
So given what we know about the weakness in official systems, what would you advise people to do when the media starts to warn us of an extreme weather event?
I think we really have to take it seriously. I think we have to make sure that we keep ourselves and our loved ones safe. And I frankly think we also need to do a lot more well before we get to the point of a warning being issued. We have chosen to really invest in recovery, disaster recovery, but we have really underinvested in disaster preventativeness. So we need to ask some really hard questions about development patterns, about where we're building our homes, about whether we should rebuild, whether we're willing to invest in things like surge barriers, whether we've really invested in the meteorological systems that will allow us to have 5-7 days to prepare for these storms. We haven't done that. I think it's time to really commit to that.
Those are tall marching orders, but I agree with you totally. We've been talking with Catherine Miles, author of Superstorm, 9 days Inside Hurricane Sandy. Aside from the big picture and personal advice, it's a terrific drama in the book, wound around a series of personalities well drawn by the author, I think. Find more links for this story in my weekly Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. Catherine Miles, thank you so much for the book and for talking with us.
My pleasure. I was so glad to be here.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.